Welcome to RSN 927 Summer Breakfast.
Good morning, Maisie. How are you? Good to have you back.
Getting there, yeah. Thank you.
How are you feeling?
I wouldn't say I'm 100%, but I'm getting back to full fitness. Should be able to play this week.
Smile on your face. And thanks to Quinny for filling in for a few days.
Thank you to Quinny and Gareth on Wednesday
as well. Gareth on Wednesday,
of
course.
And that was panic stations around here. Yeah. We're running out of people. We're low.
Going there, but yeah.
We need list sizes to be extended.
A bit like the Indian test team, but continue to keep rocking and rolling, don't they?
Yeah, we've really tested the depth here. So, no, big thank you to Quinny for Thursday and Friday. And Gareth on Wednesday. I had my first COVID test.
Did you?
That was...
How was it? I haven't had one yet.
No,
I haven't had to
fine.
Have one.
I
haven't left the home for 6 months or something more than nearly a year. How was it?
No, it was not too bad. They just shove a thing up your schnoz and then down your throat. And yeah, no, it's not that bad. I actually thought it was going to be like, I remember at the start of COVID, you remember seeing those massive, it looked like foot-long needles going up your nose into areas they don't want, you don't want them to go. But no, it was okay. They just do it up each nostril and then
quick
down your throat.
Quick turnaround as well?
Yeah, it was only about, it was less than 24 hours.
Gee,
so
good.
They did very well. There was a bit of a backlog from Queensland as well, so they expected it to take a little bit longer.
You've done well. And I mean, the thing about it is, like, you're right, at the start of the pandemic, it was like the worst thing you could ever get. Now everyone sort of had one. It's not too bad. I remember my daughter screaming one day thinking that she was going to have to get one day. She hasn't, but others in the family have, and they've gone through it, but not us.
No, I remember... Taylor Adams talking about it, and you think of these tough footballers. I mean, Taylor's as tough as they get in the middle of the ground for Collingwood. And he was talking about it going, geez, it's a bit invasive. And I thought, God. I turned up, and it was all good.
Well, I hope they're used to it because it's going to be, we had Jack McRae on Friday, and he said he had more than 50 in 2020. And I think they're going to be the same this year. There won't be any different this year.
Now, here's a question for you. Mm. 3, 4, 5 weeks ago, before we had that little outbreak at Black Rock, did you think that footy season would be as close to normal as possible? And what do you think about it right now, where, 2 months out from the start of round one?
I was always a little bit negative in terms of the impact that it was still going to have. Even 3, 4 weeks ago, I remember Scotty talking about it and Scotty thinking it was going to be, I was of the other opinion that it was always going to be a little bit, not compromised, but a little bit different. There's going to be still that spectre of COVID over the top. And I'm probably even more convinced about that now, the way things are, that there'll be a period. I mean, there's going to be bubbles. There's absolutely no doubt. Whether it gets to the stage of a hub, we're not so sure. But the players internally have been told to just be wary of, you know, that there's still the strong possibility that a hub could take place. Let's hope it doesn't. But I mean, even we've had even Brett Sutton, I think it was last week, sort of suggesting that it's not going to be footy as we know it. It's going to be sort of a little bit of a hybrid from 2020. But hopefully, the important thing is hopefully where we are with Victoria and Melbourne at the moment is that we still get games here. And we saw last night at the MCG, you could get a crowd into the MCG. We've seen that. Tennis is going to be very interesting what happens there. And it's a really good test case going forward for the other sports.
It's a huge test case, especially even from a racing perspective, the internationals coming from overseas.
Yeah, it is.
We didn't. How many? I mean, we ended up having quite a strong Melbourne Cup.
And I was surprised
by
that, to be honest. Like, it's quite extraordinary.
Well,
really.
I remember Matt Stewart and the guys debating on the verdict for weeks on end. This was sort of mid year while we were having stage 4 lockdowns, etc. That it might be a local Melbourne Cup.
Yeah.
And we ended up with one of the strongest fields of all time from an international perspective. But it is, I mean, no one was out, and very few people were able to come out with the horses.
It's very
limited. Andreas Voller came out, didn't he?
He did.
He was one of the only sort of head trainers.
Because you have to do, like, that hard quarantine.
Yeah.
And it's really hard if you're in control of horses. And I think, did Andreas come through Sydney? I think he may have come through Sydney or something along those
lines. Or Adelaide, one of the
Or Adelaide. It might have even been Adelaide. That he came through a situation where he was able to, you know, have a bit of a quarantine, but wasn't as hard locked as it would have been here in Melbourne. And he would have been glad he had a pretty good spring here as well. But I think, it's going to be interesting to see what happens next carnival time. We're still, you know, we're still a fair way away from that. Hopefully things are a little bit back to normal, relatively normal with the vaccine being run out.
Yeah.
We need it, don't we?
sure
across
do.
The world. When you look across the world,
tennis could do with it.
Oh, tennis could do at the moment. It's huge troubles, and as we know, overnight a third flight has now been implicated with a positive COVID test. This one from Doha as well. So we had three positive tests from a LA flight. We've had the one from Abu Dhabi and one from Doha, which means more than 70. Players and support staff and the like, and media involved. And of course,
so it's now 72 players in hard
unbelievable.
Lockdown.
And that's hard lockdown, unless you're one of the players who are trying to get out, which a few have tried to organise that, which is not
that.
Ideal. And
a few
Uber Eats parties and the like. And not great from Novak Djokovic, is it? The reports overnight that he sent a letter to Craig Tiley in regard to, what the players want and some of the, I wouldn't say demands, but certainly the things that he wants, and some of those, the first couple are okay if you're talking about, fitness and training material in your rooms and, decent food, that's fair enough. We saw, I don't know if you saw Stan Wawrinka sitting up there on his big table there with his food as well, which is quite good. But the talking about the other implications that he's thrown in about reduced days of isolation, that's a big cross. Permission to visit coach and trainer, that's a big cross. Don't they have Zoom and the like there? And move players to private homes with tennis facilities there.
Spare me, know that.
Not sure that a lockdown Melbourne that has been locked down, for much of 2020 is going to be that forgiving in regard to that.
Through the morning, I really want to test everyone's temperature with, pardon the pun, with what's happening with the Australian Open at the moment. So let us know. Are you keen for the Australian Open to go ahead, or should it be postponed? Let us know throughout the morning, 1-300-652-927, or shoot us a text, 0416 90 50 52. After 7:30 this morning, we are going to catch up with Peter Johnston. He, of course, called off his tournament at Kooyong. Now, a lot of that is to do with the logistics around that, but we know now that some of the Aussies who are based in Melbourne are going to have to use Kooyong as a base for their training, because Melbourne Park is now the domain of a number of lesser quarantined players as such who are allowed out for those training hours.
Yeah, it is. And I think that's the thing. Like what you've said about the people texting and ringing in, I think it'd be great, the listeners, because I think there's, as far as sporting events go, Maisie, the Australian Open is so intrinsically linked to the fans. There's this great connection between the fans and the event.
Yep.
If things start to go awry and there's some issues, and we're already seeing that sort of relationship gets frayed a bit, doesn't it?
No doubt about that. First text to come in, why are we even having the tennis? Yep. As I said, this has disaster written all over it. I reckon that's pretty much summing up the mentality of the entirety of Victoria. We're normally enjoying the company around now of Peter Johnston in the studio previewing the Kooyong Tennis Classic, but unfortunately it has been postponed. Maybe that was a very good move if you look at what's happening for the Australian Open at the moment. Peter Johnston joins us on the line this morning. Of course, he's director of a few tournaments around the world. We'll get an insight from him now. Pete, good morning and welcome back to RSN 927.
Morning, mate. Yes, a very different year to 12 months ago, I guess.
Very different. And I tell you what, the weather hasn't... it's half lucky you're not organising the tournament, because you haven't organised very good weather this year either, because it hardly feels like we've had a summer as of yet, but there's been so much talk about the Australian Open. First of all, I wanted to ask you, what would you do right now if you're in Craig Tiley's shoes? Would you be coming out and making a statement to the Victorian public, or would you be trying to reassure the players more than anything that they knew this was a risk and that's the process that has to take place?
Well, first, Maisie, I think he's doing a heck of a job, and I think it's the latter. He's really trying to, at the moment, manage the players as best he can in terms of this changing circumstance of players who thought they were going to be able to practice due to the situation from the flights and now not able to practice. So there's a lot of management that's going into that. And look, I think that's his main focus. It's changing all the time, and it's the one that he's really got to keep his mind on. But having said that, he's really having to take so many stakeholders with him, isn't he? Like keeping the public assured, checking in with him. I'm sure the sponsors, broadcasters, all raft of people who need the attention right now, but it's very much about a management situation.
Yeah, Peter, the link between the Australian Open and the fans is so strong. It's one of the great things about this tournament. Is that Is there any fear in your mind that there could be potentially a public backlash at this stage, with given what's happened?
Well, I don't think it's much. There's definitely an extra element to normal years there, in the sense that you're managing something that's impacted. Also, it's not just a regular event now. It's part of what we've all gone through in terms of how is this compared to what we've gone through, and et cetera. And so I think in that sense, you've got to really manage it carefully. And but I think they are doing absolutely what they can do. It's constant reassurance of the public that we're doing everything we can. I think these measures are so extreme for the players. It's been stronger protocols than any event that they've had to endure so far. So, you know, part of that is making sure that the public understand this is a safe event.
Yeah, absolutely. Peter Johnson has joined us, normally the Kooyong Classic Tournament Director, but that, of course, postponed until next year, so we'll see the guys strut their stuff at Kooyong again in 2022. Just tell us about the communication with which each of the parties as a Tournament Director, Pete. Is it something that's done via email? Is it something that you have to go through management, or do you have contact numbers and you send them all a text like it's a group party or something like that? How does that actually work in the real world?
Well, to a large degree, with most of the tournaments, Maisie, you're actually initially communicating through the managers who get the logistics done, and then you're working with the players. A lot of the lower-ranked players you tend to be working with. In this case, I think there's had to be consistent management with the whole player group, which is a really challenging thing because you've got so many players, they're all different standards, different countries, different circumstances. And I think that's what Tennis Australia have had to work so hard at. Like, you know, imagine the charter flights. Like, so normally everyone'd be booking their own flights, and you've just got, well, okay, here's the hotel list, and book an airport, pick up here. Here you're actually booking the flights, the conditions. So that it's essential that be able to talk to all the players, as well as being able to talk to the agents and their support group. So that's what's actually been even another challenge, which I think, again, Tennis Australia has just been doing their very best to try and make that happen.
As a former player yourself, you know how difficult it is to prepare for a big event like this. Take us through 14 days in hard quarantine and then coming out and then a week later playing a Grand Slam. What are the challenges there?
Oh, look, this does make it really hard, and I think that's what they're really working on at the moment. And I think what they have to do is try to keep putting the solutions to the government to go, look, can we do this? Can we do that? Now, it's unlikely to make improvements from what the government, you know, the health services people are going to agree to. But I think you have to try, because it's a really tough thing to do 14 days without being able to leave your room. And I guess the beauty, at least, is that there's 9 days before the first day of the Australian Open from the time the quarantine finishes. And I think that's throwing up a number of decisions for players. Like, there's a lot of tournaments, men and women, that are scheduled in that week. Some players may even choose not to play those tournaments because they feel like, gee, I've got to just practice and get myself right. But others might need you know, want to play a few matches, or it's all going to be different, and it's going to be a challenge. I think that's been well and truly acknowledged. Really difficult after 14 days of hard quarantine.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, if the weather gets a bit warmer as well, you're going to go from a nice air conditioned 22 degree room to maybe 40 degrees out on court too. It's going to be a whole new battle.
One thing also maybe is, you can imagine the practice court bookings for the day after after quarantine finishes. Boy, on that practice desk, it'll be very, very busy. So we're doing 10-minute slots because the players will be closing for the practice. So, you know, it's really hard on the players. And as I said, everyone acknowledges that is the situation. And, look, it's just going to be about management over the next upcoming days.
Do you still have every confidence that we'll get an Australian Open starting on Feb 8?
Yeah, of that I'm sure, because I think this is all about making sure that on the day one of the Australian Open, it's game on. And look, yeah, there's all these issues going in because it's going to be, players have been able to have had different preparations. The preparation hasn't been anywhere near ideal. But look, they've been Tennis Australia has been doing their best to appease that. You know, players have been flown out here. There's been, you know, there's decent checks, even if you lose first round at the Australian Open. And so it all gears up that you've got to get through all this period. But day one, I think, of the Australian Open, I don't see that moving, and I see it going ahead.
All right, Pete. Thanks so much for giving us an insight from a tournament director's point of view. All the best over the next couple of weeks. I'm sure we'll touch base before the Oz Open begins.
Pleasure, guys. Good to talk to you.
Peter Johnson. Thanks, Pete. There. Now, though, time to talk some footy. We'll focus in on the Blues with midfield coach Brent Stan, who joins us on the line. Brent, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for jumping on the show. Now, we just mentioned a couple of other sports doing the rounds this morning. In the off-season, do you get involved in anything other than footy, or is it all homework to do with the AFL season?
No, it's mostly homework, but I do enjoy getting out on the golf course and having a hit. Certainly watch all different sports over this time. It is exciting time in Australian summer to watch all the different sports that are going on.
Now, how is the golf going, by the way?
Not too bad. Still, I don't really get out too often, but when I do, I make the most of it. A lot of the players now enjoy having a hit of golf, so it's a really good avenue to build relationships and have a bit of fun with them.
Who is the best golfer at the Blues, Brent?
From a playing point of view, I think Jack Nunes is probably close. We have Oscar McDonald training with us at the moment. I think he plays off one or two, so there's a few handy golfers, and there's certainly members at some nice golf courses, which is handy.
They got me covered, Brent, I tell you. Mate, I was lucky enough to get down to watch a bit of training on Friday, and Adam Sard. I did. Adam Sard and Zach Williams. They look like they'd even lifted the standard. I know training standard. I know that sounds crazy, but they look like they've made an initial impression already. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
Yeah, it is. They've come in really with some good ideas on how we can change training up a little bit. We've set a standard here for the last couple of years that we wanted to take it with the higher intensity, and this has certainly fitted in. But as you saw, you're bringing quality players like that, and they're certainly going to lift the standard a little bit. And we're just happy that they're fitting in with the group and really taking on everything that we're saying and implementing that out on the field.
How much fighting have you had to do with the backline coach over Zach Williams, or will he be spending all the time in your group in the midfield, Brent?
No, at the moment, he's certainly spending all the time in the midfield, which I'm pretty happy about. Dale Amos and I certainly have some conversations about that, but I think I'm winning with that fight at the moment.
That's a good fight to win, I reckon, as well. So Andrew Russell spoke last week about this being the Blues' hardest preseason to date. It looks like a number of the younger players have actually built up some muscle and some strength as well. Has that been a high focus? And if so, which are the players that have stood out from that perspective?
Yeah, this group's really motivated, and I think it's a really good factor for them that even though we haven't had too much contact with them, even pre-Christmas and over Christmas, they've come back in really good shape and really fit. Andrew Russell and the fitness team have done a great job in putting the program out to them, and they've just grabbed it and run with it, and we're really excited as a football club of what we're seeing at the moment. But as we know, this is only the beginning, and it takes a lot of effort and a lot of choices in your life to be able to become an elite athlete.
Now, we saw Patrick Cripps last year not quite follow on from his amazing 2019 season. I saw Andrew Russell's comments also regarding Cripps saying that they're going to build him up a little bit more rather than strip him of weight like they tried to last year. What difference do you think that'll make in his game in the midfield in 2021?
Yeah, Cripper certainly tried something a little bit different last year. He still tried to be the prominent person who he is in the midfield with his clearances, and I still think he was number one or two in the competition for centre square clearances. So we sort of lost a little bit of that around the field just because he wanted to try and trim down and improve his running, but we want to try and get him back to his strength, and that is his clearance work. And we feel, I think he's put on a couple more kilos since last year, but the most important thing is he's a very diligent athlete and wants to get better all the time. So he's trying new things, and that's the sort of environment that we're promoting in this football club. We'll give you a license to try different things, and we'll guide you in the right direction if we think things need to change. So you're going to see him back to his powerful self and hopefully dominating clearances.
for Blues fans out there as well. How's he come back after the post-season shoulder surgery?
Yeah, he's really good. He's ahead of schedule. We're being quite careful with that. As we know, he feels good and he wants to do everything, but the medicos and the fitness staff are certainly holding him back to a degree, but he's going to be right, ready to go, hopefully by our first pre-season game.
Brent, there's been a much publicised squeeze on a support staff and assistant coaches due to COVID and the cutbacks there. Has it made your job and assistant coach's job more labour-intensive in a lot of ways?
A little bit. I suppose it's unfortunate that we lost some really good people in the industry because of all the cuts. But at the end of the day, as a football department, we've come together and sort of said we have to pick up the slack in certain areas. And yeah, there's a little bit more work, but you just enjoy. We're pretty fortunate we get to work in this industry and do something that you love day in, day out, spending all this time with the players. So there's certainly no qualms about that. We just get on with our job and give these players the best opportunity to succeed.
And just in terms of, the COVID scenario of 2021, we're not sure what's going to happen. But have the players been, well briefed by the AFL in terms of whether bubbles or potential hubs are an option in 2021?
I can't speak for the players, but certainly there is still some things up in the air on knowing what's going to happen this season. But I think to everyone's credit, last year they adapted so well and we just got on with it. And we want to provide a really good spectacle, not only for the wider community, but for our supporters in 2021. And we're going to play an exciting brand of footy, whether that's in a hub or whether that's whatever it is. These guys are just getting on with their job at the moment and preparing for a season, as the AFL have said it's going to be.
Brent, how's the reserve system going to work initially at the start of this season? Because obviously, new competition being formed, you've got the midfield group, which is pretty much the biggest at every club. How do you work with those who aren't playing senior footy? And how have you managed that at the start of this year, even though it's only a couple of weeks old?
Yeah, so it's going to be a south-eastern conference. I think they're going to play 16 or 17 games and they're going to split up into different conferences across that. The beauty of it is I'm pretty sure that when we travel interstate that those teams are going to play a curtain raiser interstate as well. So we're going to see a lot of them play football. It's just about sharing your time and making sure that we're still developing these young guys. As you mentioned before, the football department has been cut down, so there's probably not as many development coaches. So what we're providing for these players is we need to teach our older guys how to educate as well and be able to do that on the track. But it's certainly trying to split your time and just spend as much time with everyone as possible. And that's the key thing in this day and age is time is key and you got to make the most of it while you got it.
Now, Brent, we saw David Teague. I saw a few photos of him at training, just getting involved in a few of the one-on-ones. And then I remember halfway through last year, there was a bit of a chat between a few of the youngsters at Carlton that was on the website about who would win a one-on-one between our very own Daniel Harford, who normally sits in this very chair, and David Teague. And they actually thought Half might have the edge. In your opinion, having seen Half, who I'm sure has probably been at the club a few times with the women's program at the moment, who would win a one-on-one marking contest between Teague and Harford?
Well, just because Teague is my boss, I'd say Teague. But,
good answer.
No, they're both very competitive animals, and it'd be a really exciting thing to watch. So we might have to see that up and get some cameras out here, and you guys can have a chat about it.
I like that.
Good.
That'd be great.
We'll have to get it done before Half actually returns. Otherwise, he might get injured and not be back in the chair for a while. Take more holidays. Brent, great to catch up with you. All the best for the Blues in 2021. Very much looking forward to the season ahead, and it'll be here before we know it. Good luck.
Thank you very much, guys.
Some good news for the Canes. The coach joins us on game day, which we're very appreciative of. Adam Griffith, good morning to you.
Morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for jumping back on the line. Now, I'm interested in, we've asked plenty of players what they get up to on game day. What does the coach do on game day? What does your morning and afternoon look like?
When they're night games, you've obviously got a fair bit of time, so you try and relax a little bit, go through, a little bit of footage again, and we'll do our bowlers prep meeting this afternoon to make sure everyone's ready to go. But I'll be watching a bit of NFL this morning, actually.
Are you a napper during the day?
No, I'm not. I sort of try and get as much sleep at night as I can, and once I'm up and about, I'm sort of up and I don't really nap. So, yeah.
Chiefs 16, Browns 3, by the way, and then we've got the Saints and the Buccaneers a little later on this morning.
Yeah, I think the second one will be the best game.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Now, tell us about the last couple of games. I mentioned you've stumbled a little bit. Do you put it down to anything in particular, or is it such a fickle game, T20, that it only takes a couple of things to be off and you can drop games in a row like you have?
Yeah, I think these tournaments, with the amount of games you play, every team goes through ups and downs, and, you know, we've had it every year for the last couple of years where we've, you know, you get your runs and you play really well and you have little stumbles, and it's about trying to get that momentum and winning games at the right time. So hopefully we've had our little down period and we can start winning some games towards the end of the tournament.
Adam, Maisie's had a little lazy $10 on the Canes to win the tournament. Do you still feel like it's such a compacted sort of ladder at the moment that anything's possible and that your best is still good enough against all of the teams in the comp left?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we know that we've got the talent in our group to beat anyone when we're playing well. So, you know, I think we beat the Sixers first game and, you know, they're top of the ladder. So we know we've got the ability. It's just making sure that, you know, we do that consistently, and, you know, our batting group hasn't quite fired the way they'd want to yet, but as I said, we know we've got the talent in there to do the job, and hopefully that gets underway for us tonight.
The pressure's been on the top order there. Is there a change of mindset that you guys are looking towards for the rest of the tournament?
A little bit, and I think there'll be a bit of a change in personnel as well, with Ingram out and Jack's coming back in. So he'll play a bit of a different role up the top there to try and get us going, get a bit of a spark for us, and hopefully that helps us out.
Fascinated with Ben McDermott's summer. Now, I've been a fan of Ben for a couple of years now. We actually had him on the show a few years ago, and he mentioned that one-day cricket at that stage was his favourite form of cricket to play. Where do you see him long-term? Is he going to be someone as a keeper that can always open the batting in the role that he's playing at the moment?
I think Ben's... what makes Ben such a good player is he can bat in a lot of different roles. And I think, ultimately, to play for Australia, initially he'll probably be playing that sort of middle order role, but for us, you know, we want him facing as many balls as he can, you know, to make as many runs as he can. He's got a couple of 90s off 50 balls for us this year, and, you know, he was the leading run scorer up until, I think, a game or two ago. So again, like you said, the T20 game, it's, you know, it can be a bit up and down, and he's had that sort of a tournament this year, but his best is he's very destructive and as good as anyone going around.
And tell us about, I've been fascinated with Darcy Short's bowling. Mm. It seems to have come on quite nicely. He's picking up a number of wickets too with those wrist spinners. Is that something he's been working on closely over the last 6 weeks or so?
We've had him as one of our frontline spinners for a couple of years now. But I think now people are really starting to see how good he actually is. And he bowled a lot in the Shield in Adelaide before the start of the Big Bash, which helps a lot. You know, the more overs you're bowling, obviously, you know, that gets your consistency up. But his confidence level with the ball is pretty high at the moment. And anyone that can turn the ball both ways, he's going to be a weapon. And he's showing that he's a frontline spinner now and a genuine all-rounder.
Good to see him back in the runs as well. And he's only 41 runs away from being the first man for the Hurricanes to score 2,000 BBL runs. Just wanted to ask you about James Faulkner and where he's at the moment and what's going on there.
He had another little bit of a setback yesterday at training. Just sort of tightened up in his hamstring again. But look, he's doing everything he possibly can to try and get back. And fingers crossed we can get him, you know, towards the end of the tournament. Same thing happened last year with his calf. He blew that sort of about the same time of the tournament as he did this year. So, and he managed to find his way back by the end. So we're hoping he can. But you know, hamstrings, you never know.
Adam, thanks so much for your time. As always on RSN 927, we've got a loyal Tasmanian listenership as well, so they all very much appreciate your company. Good luck tonight. Hopefully the cane train can get rolling again.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Thanks for having me, boys.
Adam Griffin. So I'll get to that in just a second. It's time to talk a bit of cricket now, though, with Merv Hughes, who joins us on the line, legendary Aussie Quick. Merv, good morning to you.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are we?
We're going better. Smith. We're going a lot better than the quarantine tennis players at the moment. That's for sure.
Struggle, isn't it?
Oh, I tell you what, I think it actually shows how good India have been through. I know we had a few troubles with them, but in terms of overall spending an entire summer away from home, they're going to be away for a long time through the year. All these cricket players from around the world. It's a real credit to the cricket fraternity as a whole to get this series done and dusted.
I suppose the big thing about that is that they came in, it's 3 months ago now, isn't it? And they had time to quarantine then, and there was a few hiccups along the way, but ultimately they've run it really well. And when you're flying guys in from all over the world, I suppose that's the risk you're going to have to take with the tennis, isn't it?
Yeah. And all these T20 competitions around the world as well are going to be faced with similar circumstances with people flying in from all over the world. But the fast bowlers, yes, they Merv, great to have you on with such experience. Did they get their length wrong yesterday in terms of bowling at those tail enders? And should Australia have cleaned up India a lot earlier than what they did?
Oh, mate, you can argue both ways. The thing is that as the test stands now, with two extended days to go, don't forget that they're going to play up extra time. So I think there's an extra session to be played. Who would you rather be, India or Australia? Australia's got a 33-run lead. They're none for 21, they're none for 54 at the moment, virtually. So of the Australians, I thought they bowled really well and a pair got away from them, Washington and Thakur got away from them, 62-67 respectively, with the partnership of 120 for the seventh wicket. And I suppose when you got a side in that much trouble, you're just thinking that, yes, we should run through them. But ultimately, heavy workload in Sydney, two new players they wouldn't have had plans for. So they can fully understand it. And yeah, at times, if you're going to be super critical, we could probably say that they didn't really go after them hard enough. I reckon they bowled too conservatively at times in that partnership, and when they started to go short and upset the pair, that's when they got the wicket.
Yeah, sure did, didn't it, Merv? How tough and how delicate a decision is it for Tim Payne in terms of that declaration and when it comes to allow yourself enough time to get the win, given there's some rain forecast on both days?
Yeah, well, there's 60% chance today and 80% chance tomorrow. But that's got to go to the back of your mind. You can't sit there and think, well, we've got to declare in case it rains, and then it doesn't rain and you look like a bit of a dill and you get criticised for that. So for the Australians today, if they bat well, they could declare around T just after T if there's no real loss. And we know the showers up in Sydney. When they talk about showers, it normally sweeps through. It doesn't hang around. So they have big, heavy showers. You might lose an hour or so, but hopefully there won't be too much time lost. And as a player, you can't think about that. You just got to think about the game. So for the Australians, I reckon they'd be looking to bat till about T, and a lot of people will say, well, that didn't work in Sydney. For the Australian bowlers, I don't reckon they've had that much luck. They had a lot of luck in Adelaide, maybe bowled them out to 30-odd, but a combination of not having that much luck and not holding catches, and that's really un-Australian for this Australian team. So hopefully they'll get a little bit of luck in the second innings and the boys will hold the catches.
Tell us about the decision around the declaration as well. Who makes that? Is it entirely Tim Payne and maybe the vice-captain of the Aussie cricket team? Or is that shifted to where Justin Langer would almost have all the input now in consultation with Tim Payne?
Well, they'd sit there and talk about it. Tim Payne would have his idea. He'd talk to Smith and Warner. He'd talk to Justin Langer about it. There's no doubt about that. And the good thing about it, the captain will probably be in the rooms. They'll have a target. And they might even have an allocated time. So when the declaration's coming up, you'll know. You'll just see a little bit more urgency in the Australian batting. But the first hour, the first session today, will just go as normal. Then you should see Australia start to push it after lunch. And then when a declaration is near, there'll be blokes just batting like it's 2020.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to Cameron Green hopefully teeing off like he did in the last Test match. Yeah, which was fantastic.
Yeah. Merv, he's got a couple of gears, hasn't he? He just batted along, and all of a sudden you got a sense of a declaration because he hit 4-6 about 10 balls.
Yes.
went from about 40 to 80 in no time.
On that as well, how important is it for Cameron Green, as a number 6 batsman, to actually have those different gears to go to? I mean, that's a huge asset that he's got.
Oh, yeah, fantastic. There's no doubt about that. A young man, he looks pretty unfazed, pretty comfortable at this level, doesn't he? But for Australia to do really well, I'd prefer Cameron Green, as good as he is, not to bat today. If Warner can bat for a bulk of the time, we're going to get runs. And you know, he scored 20 off about 21, 22 balls last night, showed his intent, didn't he? Just came out, hit a couple of boundaries, and there was no real rush or concern from him. He's just got to bat normal, and then Marnus Smith, we know he can go through the gears. And then Matthew Wade, he's a good sort of white ball player. So if those guys do the job, then Cameron Green may well not have to bat.
Yeah, that would be the ideal scenario. Big day today for Marcus Harris. He's 1 from 14. How important is this innings to prolong his stay in the Test squad at the moment, with obviously Will Pekowski hot on his heels once he's fit again?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. He's got to perform today. If he doesn't perform today, they've got a fair break till the next Test. You'd think that Will Pekowski would be fit and right for that. He's got to make runs and put pressure back onto the selectors and give them a reason to pick him. The pretty soft dismissal in that first innings, wasn't it? There's no real need for him to do anything different. He's just got to bat. And if he can bat in partnership with Warner, just while the strike over, give Warner the strike, he's done his job.
Yeah, Crash Craddock is of the opinion that it's not just Marcus Harris that's career's on the line, in a sense, over the next couple of days. Is that unfair, do you think, Merv? How many wholesale changes do you think we'll have in this side going forward to the Ashes the next summer?
Oh, mate, there won't be wholesale changes, no. Will there?
Not many, would you? It wouldn't be many, but there'd be a few.
You've got to think the bowling attack is pretty good.
Yep.
The spin bowlers, so you've got the three fast bowlers, and you've got back up there.
What about the batting?
You've got the spin bowler. I'll get to that. Nathan Lyon, who's, you know, you're not going to go past him. Probably the question is how long Tim Payne continues.
Mm.
So you may have to find a keeper and a captain. And then the batting, right from the start, we'd always worried about the two spots, wasn't it? So that number 5 spot. I think Cameron Green was always going to come in and bat in that number 6 spot, and he seems to have found his footing there. So Matthew Wade at number 5 and Harris as the opener. You would think Davey Warner would be there, Labuschagne and Smith. So there's really only 2 spots to be looking at, and those guys have got to give the selectors a reason not to drop them. At the moment, they're giving them every reason to drop them.
Yeah. Merv, we've had a number of SMSs since you were on about the art of fast bowling, the art of swing bowling as well.
You're talking to the wrong bloke there.
Well, you're a fast bowler. At least you can give us a bit of an insight to the fast bowling. The lack of reverse for Australia, is it something that is still we're still behind in compared to the rest of the world, or what do you think the reason behind that is?
It's an interesting one. The ball really hasn't seemed to swing for us this year, even new ball. So Mitch Stark is predominantly the swing bowler in the Australian team, and he's had a few problems moving the new ball in particular. And when the ball tends to reverse swing, he's the man that gets it done. So there hasn't been too much swing, and we compare them to what India does, and they're swinging the ball. So I'm not sure what the reason there is, but they did an experiment, or they came up with this theory a couple of years ago. When I say a couple of years ago, it'd be 20, 25 years ago, that if you're, Troy Cooley did it, in fact, if you're bowling between the speeds of, I think it was something like about 78 miles an hour and 83 mile an hour, the ball's not going to swing. For some reason, the ball doesn't swing, and that's basically where the Australians bowl. Now, on a good day, Mitch Stark gets above that, and the ball swings. But at the moment, they all seem to be bowling around that pace. And of Hazelwood and Pat Cummins, they're not real big swingers of the ball. They tend to hit the wicket and do a little bit more off the seam. But it's a little bit of a concern that Mitch Stark... Now, and like I said, when Express, he's bowling a little bit faster than the ball swings, but he might be in that category where he's just bowling at those speeds where the ball doesn't swing. Now, for what reason that ball doesn't swing in that speed zone, I have no idea.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a mystery for us for a number of years now. Merv, thanks so much for your time, as always, on RSN 927. We really appreciate it. Enjoy the next 2 days of Test cricket. It's going to be fantastic. Okay, finish.
We hope so. And just before I go, boys, going to send a shout-out to Frankie Alessio down at Bairnsdale, the best brim fisherman in the world.
G'day, Frankie.
Fantastic.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.